Hello and welcome to Scoreheads, your regular helping of soundtrack-loving goodness dedicated to the love of the music of both big and small screens, and a show that celebrates that very same music and the creators of it by sitting down with the many maestros involved industry-wide to hear their stories about making the notes that emote. Welcome once again, I'm John Brown, host of film podcast We're Gonna Need a Bigger Pod, Express FM's resident film correspondent, and also host of soundtrack-focused interview-based specialist radio show The Composer Series. Joining me is top film and soundtrack journalist, fabulous author, fellow film score nerd, and top quality gent, Mr. Sean Wilson. Sean, it's time for another episode. Sir, how are you?
I'm very good, thanks. So I'm blushing from all those superlatives, so thank you for those.
I do love a superlative.
Especially when they all line up like buses like that.
There are a few people right now going... Don't you just.
Yeah, absolutely. So I can't get in the room, my head's so big.
Bless you, sir. Well, you're deserving of every single one of them. Grateful, as always, to have you on this journey with us. And it's a big one this week. But before we promote the huge guest that we've got, let's promote that huge book that you've written first.
So The Sound of Cinema, Hollywood Film Music from the Silence to the Present is my debut book, out now via McFarlane Publishers, and I want to give a shout out to them, actually, for being such great supporters throughout the whole process. This was written during initially during COVID lockdown in 2021, then outside of lockdown, so it was a real kind of passion project for me that I was able to devote myself to. It begins in, you know, with the early nascent era of cinema and subsequent soundtrack music. Then it traces through the likes of Herman, Korngold, Steiner, onwards to people like North, Goldsmith, Williams, Bernstein, so on and so forth. And then right through to the present day with the likes of Hans Zimmer. So it's all about, how did film music start? Where did it go from there, and where are we now? Are we in a good place? Are we in an indifferent place? Are we in a bad place? If you have found yourself watching a blockbuster recently and thought, oh, the music in that was really striking, please do go and pick up a copy, because it might illuminate a few things. Well, hopefully it will. So,
just to pick up on quite beautifully from what you just said there, I think maybe some folks have watched a blockbuster recently that we're about to talk about and thought all about that music. Well, if that's a question that you need answering, how did John Murphy make the music of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3? Then by all means, listen to this podcast, then go and buy the book. I mean, John's not in the book, or is John in the book? I can't remember.
He's mentioned in the book.
He is, yes, yeah, he is. No, you're right.
Actually, I do go into a chapter, well, sort of a segment of a chapter on the development of the Marvel Cinematic Universe scores. So, you know, anyone who buys the book can get stuck into that particular area.
So, yes, by all means, check out Sean's book. It is incredible and awesome, and I love it very much, and I cannot be a bigger cheerleader for it. Oh, the idea of me being a cheerleader now, that's thrown up some interesting...
Well, that's not mentioned in my book.
No. I'm a cheerleader for the book. I am not in the book, and because that book is reserved for people far more talented than I, one of which is on this very show. Let's get to know him a little bit, though. For anyone that has not heard of John Murphy, what can we say about John Murphy? He, one of the great scores from... Britflick 28 Days Later, of course, and this was a score that went on to live in infamy as a result of that. He scored that for Danny Boyle, famously worked with Danny Boyle on a couple of projects, actually, including Sunshine, which is an absolutely gorgeous score. He also worked with Guy Ritchie on films like Snatch and Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, wrote scores for those guys as well. His now dear friend James Gunn, who he worked on The Suicide Squad with, which was a really, really great score and a really, really great movie. I love that movie. And now, following on from that, his relationship with James Gunn has grown to such that he got to work on the Guardians of the Galaxy Holiday Special. You'll never find 45 happier minutes on Disney Plus, to be honest. And then, of course, that led on to an opportunity to score the third and final chapter in James Gunn's magnum opus, which is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. John, of course, has done many, many other cool things. He worked on Kick-Ass as well, and was one of the four evil Beatles that he self-titled, because it was John Murphy, Ilan Eshkeri, who, of course, is also on this podcast, and there was also Henry Jackman, and I'm trying to remember, was it Marius de Vries?
Yes, Memories to Freeze, yes.
There we go. Mm. Because they recorded the score at Abbey Road, I think John nicknamed them the Evil Beatles. So I think Alan told me that John nicknamed them all the Evil Beatles. It's a funny story that I absolutely love from one of John's previous interviews. Mm. I've had a great pleasure of, and as have you, of speaking to him before now. So actually, if you do want to do a deep dive on John's history, I do have an episode on mixcloud.com/the composer series. Go and check that out, because we did a real deep dive on John's history from childhood up until I think Les Miserables, which he was working on at the time for PBS. So there's a good block of history there. But if you want to find out more about what he's doing right now, well, you've come to the right place, because Sean and I caught up with John recently to discuss the genesis of the score for Guardians Volume 3. Sean, how did you feel about this one, returning to a chat with John Murphy again?
Well, delighted. John was a real pleasure to speak to. Well, both you and I spoke to him about the Suicide Squad, didn't we, a while ago now? And that was the first time I'd spoken to John, and he was an absolute pleasure, and he was an absolute pleasure to talk to you this time. You're one of the second greatest John exports from Liverpool. So they turn them out. good, talented musicians called John. Yeah, he's terrific. I mean, even if people listening to this, if you don't know the name John Murphy, you will have heard his music. Believe me, you would have heard his music. In the House in a Heartbeat from the 28 Days films, Adagio in D minor from Sunshine, which is a staggeringly beautiful piece of music, is pretty, that's tracked into pretty much every faux inspirational montage in a TV show now. I mean, you will have heard that. It's a really shimmering, stunning piece of music. Yeah. And this upcoming interview, actually, because I remember speaking to you after this, saying we were really delighted at how this interview gets really, really personal in a really good way, in a really illuminating way. And it's, you know, it's always great when you can get an artist to open up like that, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. And I'm always genuinely excited to talk to John. I think this was my third sitting with John, and it's been a great privilege and a pleasure to have been able to share some of that journey with him over the course, and keep in touch with him about his developments and how his career is very much back in the frame right now, as in he's a much talked about composer, and he's, you know, when you're hot, right? And I think the last couple of years has definitely proved that John Murphy is back with a vengeance. So yes, it does get personal, but in a very good way. It also gets very funny. So here we are. Sean and I, once again, had the incredible privilege of being able to catch up with John Murphy to talk more about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. And you can hear that entire conversation right now here on your latest episode of Scoreheads.
Peter, you know this is an open line, right?
What?
We're listening to everything you're saying.
And it is painful.
And you're just telling me now?
We were hoping it would stop on its own.
But I switched it over to private.
What color button did you push?
Blue! For the blue suit!
Oh, no.
Blue is the open line for everyone.
Orange is for blue.
What?
Black is for orange. Yellow is for green. Green is for red. And red is for yellow.
No, yellow is for yellow. Green is for red. Red is for green.
I don't think so.
Try it then.
Hello! You're right.
Sean and I are so incredibly excited now to welcome on the very special guest for this episode, the brilliant, the amazing, and really quite legendary, Mr. John Murphy. How are you, sir?
I'm much better having heard that wonderful introduction, John, so thank you. And good to see you, Sean.
And you, John. Lovely to be back talking to you again.
Well, thank you so much for doing this, John. It is a real honour for me as well to be able to say, I know it's Sean's second time with you, and for me to be able to say this is actually our third chat together now, and I'm just as excited as I was the first time around, which actually puts this perfectly in place for my first question, as our last conversation was all about the amazing work that you did on the Suicide Squad. Where we left you last, of course, you guys were just bringing that movie out, and a lot has happened between now and then, and most of it with your dear friend James Gunn, I believe. So let's start there. At one point during the Suicide Squad process, did you know then that you were going to move on to Guardians, and how did you feel about it when you found out?
Well, we were about halfway through, and it was going really well, and got a very good relationship with James. I mean, you know, he was in a band, I was in bands. He was into punk, I was into punk, you know. So we always had this very easy language between ourselves. There was none of that music school and kind of sort of highbrow stuff. There was none of that. It was just a very, very cool relationship. And you know, he's great to work with. He's just such a blast. So it was all going great. And he just kind of rang me one night and said, so I really want you to do the Guardians movie. What do you think? So, of course, I was like, you know, because I love the Guardians films anyway. I mean, they're my favourite Marvel films. And James had been such a blast to work with. So, obviously, I was like, okay. You really think I'm going to say no, you know? For me, it was a double whammy because I love the movies anyway. And James has been by far the, you know, the best creative director I've worked with, you know, in terms of collaboration and just it being a very intense but very creative process. So, you know, it was a no-brainer for me. So, of course, I just said yes immediately.
Well, I remember, John, when I interviewed you before, you praised James Gunn's musical intuition. You said, like, reiterating what you said there, so he's got a great acumen, he's got great insight into music. And I wondered, like, was there, when you went into scoring Guardians Volume 3 for him, was there like a philosophy or like an idea for the score in terms of the emotion? Or
yeah, I mean, I assumed that, because I know the first two score, I mean, I'm actually a good friend with Tyler Bates, you know, I've known Tyler for maybe 10 years or something, and I really loved those scores, especially the first one. I thought it was one of the best scores that had been out for a while. And so I assumed it would be a continuation of that big epic space romantic sound. But when I spoke to James, he actually wanted something a lot grittier and more grounded, and much more of a hybrid sound. He didn't just want it to be orchestral and choir. He wanted a lot of other elements in, because in a lot of ways this movie is you know, it's a bit more raw than the first two. Mm. Partially because he has to tell a story that's very painful, you know, in terms of Rocket's journey and you know, how Rocket became what he was. So he didn't want to sugarcoat it in any way in terms of the story. And I think in his head, what he was thinking is he doesn't want the music to be necessarily a Hollywood sound. I think, just to put it in a nutshell, he was basically saying to me, we need this to be edgy, and it's got to be painful, and it's got to be gritty, and it's got to be grounded. And to do that, we need to bring in different elements than just an orchestra. And that meant trying to find new sounds that, you know, hadn't been heard before. And also to use sounds that could be very violent, could be painful, could be edgy. So that was kind of the pretty much the first creative conversation. So then I had to rethink everything. Then I was like, oh, okay, so it's not going to just be. But at the same time, you need the connective tissue. Because I'm a fan too, so, you know, I wouldn't want to go and see the final Guardians and it be a whole different thing. I'd be like, well, where's the theme? So we had to find a way to address the difference in the tone of the story, but at the same time have that connective tissue that this is now moved to a different place, and have some respect for what the music did in the first two movies, which was very successful, in my opinion. Those kind of conversations. But, you know, James would never say, oh, this has to be on drums or this has to be on. He doesn't have those conversations. You know, for James, everything is about the story and how we kind of work with the story musically is kind of left to me, you know, to come up with ideas and sort of throw stuff at him. And just get feedback, and then most of the cues bounce backwards and forwards between us. You know, I'll send two or three versions of something to him, and he'll go, oh, this middle one is the way to go. But why don't we try this, and why don't we, you know? So it's very, you know, it is very much a collaborative thing. And, you know, it was a lot of experimentation. You know, I had to try some things out to sort of get us to that place where we both felt, okay, now it's sounding like another iteration of a Guardian score without sounding like something completely different. So it was more those kind of conversations we were having, really.
Did you feel throughout that process of experimentation, as you say, and figuring out what's right for this movie, was it always a constant creative process of excitement? Was there kind of a kid in a sweet shop kind of vibe to it? Or did you feel that juxtaposition of like immense pressure that you have to essentially handle the third one, the closing chapter, this 10 years nearly of storytelling coming to a close, really, in certain respects? How did you feel about that? Was it a balance of excitement and a little bit of pressure as well, nervousness, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, it's always that kind of excitement versus fear, you know, but that's what gets you up in the morning, you know. If you didn't have that fear, you'd kind of coast it. And I've never been a coaster. I always have that sort of, you know, because it's music. You don't always have your say as a composer. You know, some mornings it's all going to come, and other mornings you've got to prize it out. There's nothing linear about writing a film score. It's, you know, some days you're on top of it, and other days you're like, nothing comes, you know. So that fear keeps you humble. And I think that's a very good trait to have as a composer. And I certainly feel humble. But you know, you learn over the years, you learn how to control the pressure. Because if you didn't, you wouldn't be able to do the job. So, you know, as long as most of the emotion is excitement and wonder as well, it's like, you know, I love getting up thinking, okay, I've got to figure this out. When I do figure this out, I wonder what it's going to be. What kind of sound is that going to be? Because you always get there. So there's always that sense of excitement, because I don't know what I'm going to do that day. It could be awesome. It could be poor. You just don't know. So, yeah, there's always that balance. But you learn to control the pressure. And the good thing with James and with Simon, the exec producer, is I always felt I had that little bit of wiggle room where if something wasn't great, I'd get a chance to just go at it again. There was a lot of trust. I never felt like, oh, if I don't nail this next scene, I'm going to get fired. There was none of that. It was very much like, John will get there, you know. So that makes it a lot easier, you know, especially because I've worked with James and Simon on three projects now. So it was, that does help a lot, to be honest. So it was just a case of getting in there and just doing it, really.
I know that was really interesting what you said there, John, about balancing the old with the new. And I think I speak for scoreheads, John, as well, when I say that I think you've done that brilliantly. And
yeah,
it's a really, really interesting mixture of, yeah, I mean, we both genuinely mean that. I mean, it's you mentioned the score is raw, but it's beautiful. I mean, the choral work, I said this to my John as well, I said that the choral work on this is just amazing. Oh, yeah. Like it is almost like a dialogue for the characters. And was that always at the forefront to use like voices like that in that pronounced a fashion?
Yeah, I mean, James likes choral pieces anyway, because you can hear a lot of choral stuff in the first two Guardians. But what set the tone for that was the very first theme I had to write, because the way James works is quite different to other directors in that he likes to shoot to a lot of the themes. So I actually had to write most of the main themes before he started shooting.
So,
you know, and that was just written from the script. So, you know, there was this huge big gap in the middle. You know, I mean, I had to write 15 or 16 themes, and then James would shoot with these themes. And sometimes he'd just have the music in his headphones. But a lot of times he'd have the music just playing like crazy loud on the set, and the actors were actually acting to the music playing. Which I love, you know. I mean,
that's fantastic.
That's great for your ego, you know. So I had to write all this stuff, and then of course, then he goes and shoots the film until there was a big gap when I was just waiting. But the very first theme I had to write was what we called, you know, for a long time, we called it the Alien Opera, and that was something very central to the philosophy behind the High Evolutionary is this piece of, this ancient piece of music, which is thousands of years old. And within that, it's really a song. Within this song are the lyrics which define the philosophy of the High Evolutionary and his ancestors. So it was a very important piece of music for the film. In fact, it's even in the film where he's playing this song, and Rocket asks him what it is, and then the High Evolutionary explains what this song is. So that was clearly a very important piece of music to write. But we had to, what I had to do was make it feel as if it was, as if it could have been an opera written by an alien civilization thousands of years ago. So
not a small task.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's just, that's James, you know. Okay, so what we got to do is this, you know. It's okay. But that's great. That's why I love working with this guy. It's like you end up doing stuff you never would have dreamed of. But, you know, it was also smart because, you know, one of the things, even though it's a space movie and we have this beautiful array of different aliens from, you got the Sovereign, you've got all these different civilizations. And you think, well, musically, you know, what would that work? They wouldn't be playing violins or oboes, you know, but the one connective tissue musically would be the voice, because if they have voices enough to speak, then they have voices enough to sing. And the idea being that that the voice is a universal music before anything else. So I thought, well, whatever it is, it's going to be this vocal thing. But I had to write it in such a way that it could feel slightly operatic without sounding like earth opera. Because, you know, the High Evolutionary is very grandiose. He's very, very melodramatic. It made sense that the sentiment of opera would be part of his musical language. But it obviously couldn't sound like Puccini or Verdi or something, because that just sounds like something that would have been written on Earth. So I had to come up with a sort of melody and a sound that made you feel like it was something in the realms of opera, but from thousands of years ago on another planet. So, and the way I the idea was that James was going to write the lyrics in an alien language. But to do that, I had to send them the melody. So I had the opera singers. I had Anna Schubert and Abdiel Gonzalez come in, who were like just unbelievable opera singers. And I wrote the lyrics in this kind of pidgin Latin, because I thought I wanted it to feel a bit otherworldly. So I wrote the lyrics in this crazy, weird Latin that I made up, and then sent James the piece of music. And from that melody with the Latin, he was then able to create this alien language that contained these philosophical words. So it was a kind of a complex back and forth, you know. And so once we had the piece of music that was played in the scene while the High Evolutionary is having a scene with Rocket, and then when I did get the lyrics from James, you know, he's the most musically savvy director I've ever worked with. You know, he listened to the melody and then he wrote this whole set of lyrics in this alien language. And then I had to get the opera singers back in to sing this new set of lyrics. And it was chilling listening, because, you know, as soon as they started singing this line, you know, Moe gaste phone, which means, you know, be not as you are, but as you should be. So it's this kind of, this drive and this mentality of perfectionism, I guess, and creating this perfect society. As soon as they sung those lyrics in the new language that James created, it was chilling to hear. And I was like, oh, wow, this is really going to work.
So you're like invoking an
alien. Yeah, exactly, yeah, you know. And when I explained what the lyrics meant and I wanted it sung in this very austere, took out. I mean, it was a shame, really, because both Anna and Abdiel have this beautiful operatic voices, but I kind of stripped out all of the operatic articulations in their voices so that it sounded almost like some Renaissance piece, this very still, very spooky, non-vibrato sound, you know, to make it feel almost like something from the 1900s, you know, when when all of that Renaissance music started, so that it felt very still and very, very, very different to opera. And they nailed it. They totally nailed it. So it was amazing to hear when they came back to sing it in this crazy alien language. It made the scene. It's such a very evocative section of the film. So that stuff, that's kind of the stuff you do with James, you know. It's never just write a tune. There's always a reason, you know. But that was a particularly interesting thing to do.
Your friend once took advantage. I learned my lessons. I aimed some small part of my mental capacity back in my own direction, and now gravity itself serves my whims. You must find Counter-Earth familiar.
Counter-Earth?
I visited your planet many years ago.
Earth hasn't been my planet in a long time.
Your people had wonderful spirit. The art and music and literature were some of the finest in the universe. Earth would be a fabulous place were it not for the ignorance and bigotry.
Okay.
It inspired me to create Counter-Earth.
I don't care.
All of the good and none of the bad.
I don't need another speech by some impotent whack job whose mother didn't love him, rationalizing why he needs to conquer the universe.
I'm not trying to conquer the universe. I'm perfecting it.
The High Evolutionary is one of the greatest villains as well. He must have been an incredible ton of fun to write music for.
He really was, because I had to write a few other big pieces in that alien sort of operatic style. And Chuck, I know Chuck too. Chuck's a great guy. He's got the Shakespeare chops as well. You know, he's got that presence. And funny story as well, when he started to prepare for the role, for the High Evolutionary, the way he prepares for any role, whether it's Shakespeare or whatever, he plays music. He makes a playlist for that character. And he'd spoken with James about the character was, and James had obviously given him every bit of information he needed. So Chuck made this playlist that had, you know, a lot of opera music and a lot of very big, grandiose, dark pieces, and he sent this playlist to James, and James picked up on one of the pieces, which is Purcell's Dido's Lament, and straight away James like sent me the playlist and said, listen to this Dido's Lament, this is just amazing, can we use this somewhere, it feels perfect for the High Evolutionary, and it's also one of my favourite pieces of music of all time. I mean, it's the saddest piece of music ever written. So I was like, you're kidding me. Wow, I'm going to be able to do this, do my own version of this. But what James wanted was this piece that started like the original Dido, but then just built and then built to this like huge, big crescendo. And I said, it just gets bigger. And I'm like, okay. So I had to start with this little arrangement of the thing, and you hear this, but then it just got bigger. And I was convinced I'd gone completely over the top, but because I ended up turning this beautiful piece of music that I've always loved into this 7-minute crescendo that sort of ended with guitars and synths. And I was like, oh my God, I just ruined one of my favorite pieces of music. So I sent it to James and I said, I really think I've gone over the top here. But, you know, here's a version of my arrangement of it. And he got back and he was going, no, I love it. You know, because if James was an amplifier, he'd be, you know, the kind of amp from Spinal Tap that goes up to 11, you know. So he's hard to shock. And I was like, sure. I mean, it kind of ends up pretty, like, monstrous, you know. And he's like, no, it's perfect. So that ended up in the movie in a very crucial scene where the High Evolutionary is again, a lot of exposition, and he's explaining what his whole philosophy is. So I got to do a kind of 28 days later version of one of my favourite pieces of music. I still think I went too far, but anyway, it feels okay in the movie. But yeah, that was a lot of fun too, you know. And it's, you know, what a tune. It's one of those pieces of music that I wish I'd written. I just love that piece. But yeah, I mean, it was a lot of fun, and I think it works good in the movie.
An actor's engagement with soundtrack music is something that I find very interesting. When you mentioned there that score was pre-written and played on the set to create mood, And I wonder, have you ever had, like, if that's happened before, have you ever had actors like come up to you and actually say, oh wow, that really kind of unlocked like inner emotions and like and got them into the scene? Like, have you ever had actors talk to you about how that helps them engage?
Before James, I'd never ever done this, so it's only been since working with James. And the only, because, you know, as a composer, you don't really mix much with the actors because they kind of do their thing and then you do your thing, you know. You might see them at the premiere or whatever. But, you know, with Chuck, I'd met Chuck at James's wedding, strangely enough, you know, and we had a big talk because I knew he was... He's also a musician himself, and he's a really good pianist. So we had a good talk about music, and he said it makes such a difference when you can feel how the end result is going to be. And, you know, he's such a fantastic actor, you know. So to hear from him sort of saying in those scenes it made a big difference and it changed his performance, it's quite a cool thing to hear, you know.
There's so much great music going on here on lots of different levels too. Like, this is an absolute masterpiece, man. From the big adventure moments to the more horrifying or the tender moments or the odes to pain, as I like to call them, and the choral work, the piano, that, and of course, thank that you, classic John Murphy grungy guitar style as well, man. I know you've given us some elements to certain pieces already, but break us down in total for us, if you will. Just what ingredients are in that soup, John? What paints were on the palette? What instruments and effects were, or other effects or techniques were utilised, making this sound just as amazing as it does?
I mean, we knew there was going to be a lot of choral stuff because, you know, there's also this quasi-religious element which goes through the movie, which goes through the score, because it needed to feel kind of gravity as well. And, you know, obviously, it also being a Marvel movie, you know, you need to have some of that Marvel sound. So there was all these big... You know, you have your palette of sounds, but, you know, some of those colours are bigger than others. And I knew at certain points we would have to go into that big Marvel superhero sound that we all know and love. So that was always on the palette, to sort of do that as and when we needed to. But in terms of making this unique, sometimes it's what you don't use, you know, that creates a space sonically that forces you to fill it with something that you wouldn't have thought of before. So it's very brass and choral heavy, but like very light with woodwinds and stuff, you know. So I was trying to create space. And even with arranging the brass, I mean, because, you know, James wanted this to have a really grindy, grounded feel in a lot of the score, I knew I had to arrange the brass in a certain way that would allow me to then get an octave or a sonic range below the brass to just fill it with big, heavy analog synths and distorted basses and that kind of thing. So I was using some of the same sounds that maybe I used in Suicide Squad, but it was a lot fatter and often a lot lower than I've used before. And to do that, I couldn't use Chimbassi if you were using, you know, loads of fuzz basses, because these sort of take up the same sonic range. So I had to kind of rethink this stuff out from the get-go. But there was, yeah, it does have that kind of grungy wall of sound thing. But I forced myself to use different guitars and basses on this, because, you know, you can get into that lizard brain thing where you pick your favourite guitar up and you end up playing the same riff. So I used a baritone guitar for this, which is quite a strange instrument. It's kind of in the middle of a guitar and a bass, where you can get like kind of low B on it. And because I have to think when I play it, because you're kind of transposing your low notes in your head, it kind of forced me to write different kind of things than I would normally write. And a lot of stuff was put through, again, distortion pedals. We recorded a lot of metal on this because, you know, there's a lot of the film, especially the middle of the film when we go to the orgoscope, there's a real metallic element. I won't give the game away, but there's a very metallic element mixed in with the organic element of this, yeah, I mean, of this planet or whatever it is. So one of the things, Tyler, my producer, he had an idea, and he went to the hardware store round the corner and then came back with all this bits of metal, just random things that, you know, he was banging. I mean, he must have thought he was out of his mind. He's probably on an Instagram somewhere now because he was banging this metal stuff in there with whatever beaters he had in the shop. He must have thought he was, like, completely out of his mind. But then he came back with all this stuff. And, you know, it was awesome because we were hitting these things. And you know, the minute you put anything through a fuzz pedal, it just kind of goes somewhere else. So a lot of the really heavy percussive sounds in the movie aren't even percussion instruments. It's just all this random metallic stuff Tyler found in the hardware store. In fact, the best sound on the movie out of the percussion is actually an immersion heater tray, which for some reason just was just this perfect big... So there's a lot of that stuff in the movie. But it's like anything. I mean, whenever we get a new instrument, after about 30 seconds, we tend to look at each other and go, let's see what it sounds like through a fuzz box. So everything ends up in... I think I've fuzzed everything that's ever come into the studio. So eventually everything gets fed through a big muff or some kind of distortion unit, you know. So, and that just changes everything. But yeah, we were using... I used a lot of gongs and thunder sheets through different pedals. And, you know, so you... Because you want a sound that no one's heard before, you know. So a lot of that atmospheric stuff was really just mostly random bits of metal. But one awesome addition was something called a Marvin. Now, a Marvin is actually an instrument, but it looks like some kind of medieval torture device. It's like something out of an old 1920s car with all these springs coming off it and wires. And it's got like this big flared echo chamber that you can put a microphone into. And then, but the minute you hit it, it sounds like it's got a 30-second reverb on it. So that got used a lot. And I bought this thing called a tongue drum from a guy called Boris in Hungary, I think. And it's like this little metal UFO with sort of tongues cut into it that are tuned, so you can play this little thing. It's almost like a spooky, ghostly xylophone. and it was awesome. So I ordered like another 8 or 9 from this guy in all these different keys. And that was a sound I've never heard on a movie before. In fact, the very opening of the score, the very opening of the movie, that little sound you hear like ding, 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 it's got like echoes on it. That's actually the tongue drum. So, but you know, all of these little things, they just add to the palette. They can make, you know, sometimes you write something on strings and you're like, oh, here we go, just sounds like strings. But the minute you put some of these other elements mixed in with it, it starts to sort of influence the ear as to what you hear, and so the strings suddenly sound a bit swirly or strange. And so, you know, it was a lot of that kind of stuff. So it was predominantly still an orchestra, but the minute you start messing with other instruments and sort of blending things in, especially with choral stuff too, you start to create a sort of overall set of colours that feels a little bit otherworldly and a little bit alien. So, but I love all that stuff, you know. It's like the minute something sounds like it's supposed to, I just get bored. It's like, what can we do to this up? So, you know, that isn't a fuzz pedal. So there was a lot of that kind of stuff, but that's what I wake up for, you know. I mean, just taking something and messing around with it and whatever.
Yeah, I mean, implicitly, the use of sounds in science fiction, I mean, implicitly, I suppose you're continuing in a tradition of like Jerry Goldsmith, Planet of the Apes, aren't you, where he used whisks, I think, like whisks and bowls and all manner of stuff. Like,
yeah, I mean, you know, to be honest, it goes all the way back to Bernard Herrmann and using theremins. And it's like there's something special about space movies to a composer, because within 3 seconds you're thinking, what would it really sound like? Because, you know, it's one thing doing a normal film and you go, okay, there's your orchestra or there's your piano or whatever. But the minute it's in space, you know, everything becomes infinite and everything is possible. it's within seconds you're thinking, what can I do to give a new spin on this, or you know, or to make this feel like you actually really are approaching a planet that the audience has never seen before, the Earth people have never seen before, and you can't just use strings, you know?
Well, yeah, because why should something feel earthbound if we're not on Earth? There might be so many different sounds that we haven't heard, but to our human ears,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to do a science fiction film where there wasn't a single sound that you could recognise, you know, to really go for it. It'd probably kill the movie and get me fired, but what would it truly feel like, you know, to have sounds that no one has ever heard before? I mean, that would be awesome to do, but still have to make a movie, so you got to kind of meet it halfway somewhere.
Oh, I'm here for the concept album.
Yeah. One day, it'd have to be a really low-budget indie movie where they didn't care, you know, and I'd get to, like, invent some instruments or something. That would be cool.
Yeah.
What was your favourite Guardian or character within this movie to write music for? This is a two-part question. So who is your, if you had a favourite Guardian or a favourite character in particular, I kind of think maybe we've answered this already, but if you did, who was it to write music for? But also, of the Guardians of the Galaxy themselves, who would you say you were most like, John, if you could pick?
It's actually the same answer, really. It would be Rocket.
Amazing.
And the reason he was the most enjoyable to write for this was, you know, his story is very wide, you know. It's, I mean, the whole movie is very emotionally dynamic, but especially so for Rocket, because, you know, we go from these scenes of real violence and shock and trauma, you know, and the music had to reflect that, but you also go to these moments of pure tenderness and warmth. So, you know, sometimes right next to each other, you know, so I'd be doing some of the most violent music I've ever written, going straight into some of the most tender music I've ever written. So having that scope and, you know, such a deep well with Rocket, because we're finding things, you know, things are being revealed about him that we didn't know before. And, you know, for any composer, you know, the deeper the well, the more interesting it is to write music for. So yeah, I mean, for sure it was Rocket. And also because, you know, because Rocket's so central to this story, you have that scope to take the journey from beginning to a middle and an end. And musically, it's always nice to know that you have that kind of big shape to work within. That you're not, you know, you haven't just got, oh, I got to, you know, put it all into this scene. Or with Rocket, I knew that I could start in a certain place. I could bring the audience through a certain place and conclude and resolve at a certain place. So could have written an entire score for Rocket in this movie, because it was all there and it was all in the script as well. I mean, you know, the things I cried at when I watched the film at the premiere were the things I cried at when I read the script, and the things that shocked me and the things that made me feel good, it was all there in the script, you know. It was already in there. So Rocket just had the bigger, deeper well for me to write from. And in terms of which character I'm most, I mean, yeah, you know, I'd say Rocket again, but I don't want to say why. I think I relate to that kind of traumatized, wounded guy, I think. That, you know, anyway, that's another story. So
I don't know who we'd be.
I had to think about that myself. It was one of those things, yeah, where I was like, I'm going to ask John, and then was like, hang on a minute, that question's going to come back. And I'm like, no, I don't know.
Pull his nuts out. I get it, yeah.
Actually saying that, no, I'm a little bit, I guess I'm a little bit like Star-Lord. The heart of gold, but the bit quick with his mouth. You know, I think there's some likeness there for sure.
I think.
Yeah, I think I'm like Star Lord, the really sexy guy. Yeah. I
think oh no.
I think I'd say Drax because I think I have a problem with irony sometimes. Sometimes I just don't get people's jokes, and I'm just like, and then I don't catch it straight away, and it's like, oh yeah, now I get what they're talking about. So, yeah.
We weren't in.
Fun question, yeah.
We weren't in shoeing, yeah. John, that you were the small furry one, mate. Promise.
What I really love about this score, John, this applied to the Suicide Squad as well, was that your own musical heritage very much shines through, even when you're working within this like big budget blockbuster arena. I can still recognise your stylistics from your other scores that you've done, like Sunshine, like 28 Days, 28 Weeks Later, and I really, really like that. And I suppose for you, that's just kind of, is that just baked in there as like a stylistic thing? Is that something that you gravitate towards? Like,
no, I gravitate away. It's just that it's so baked in. I know, it's funny. It's like every movie I start, I'm going, okay, don't sound like John Murphy. I really do. It's like, but there's something. See, I think there's a certain look. Every composer has his DNA, and it's a lot of to do with the record collection. It's a lot to do with the records that they've listened to and loved, and it's a lot to do with what they've absorbed. But you know, I have this theory that what sticks with you the most is the most intense part of your musical awakening kind of stays with you the most, you know. And for me, it was that period where I taught myself to play guitar, and I was about 11 or 12, and I started playing in my first school bands and stuff like that, you know, where you're practicing in a church hall and you just turn everything on full. And you, for me, that was still the most exciting time of my musical life. And what I was playing then was, even though we were playing Beatles songs and we were playing all kinds of stuff, we played because we were kids, we played everything like at 100 mile an hour. So, we were sort of like a punk band, but playing whatever we played sounded like a punk band, you know. And we ended up getting gigs as pubs and stuff. And that was our sound, you know, everything was like 100 mile an hour. And because we were just so excited. It wasn't like we were trying to be a punk band or anything. Although we were kind of half trying to be a punk band. But it was just everything we did was just too exciting for us. So, you know, we would play songs in like a minute and a half because we were just smashing through these songs. And that was that's still to this day the most exciting. Those couple of years where we were playing all the pubs and clubs in Liverpool as these kids and then going to school the next day. But the night before, we played in front of 20 people. And played all these songs and sung them, you know, with our little PA system. That's still the most exciting time of my musical life. And I think when that happens, it never leaves you. So there's still a part of me now where when I pick a guitar up, I don't noodle, you know. I go like, ba-da-da-da-da-da. It's like nothing's changed. It's like I'm stuck in that moment of, this is awesome, bang, 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 you know. It's like, and it's, you know, it's like at some point I'm going to have to grow out of this, but it's still, it's like when I get a new pedal, it's like, you know, there's a way of testing out a new pedal where you put everything at noon and you feather your input in so you get a, I've never done that. I get a new pedal and I'm like 10, ba-da-da-da, you know, it's just in my DNA to be as loud and as fast as possible from the get-go, I think. So I think that thing is baked in. I think it really is baked into me. It's, you know, really only when I pick a guitar or a bass up. But yeah, sadly, it's very much baked into me to sort of go into that mode as soon as I pick a guitar up. It's just the way things are. I would love to change it.
I was just gonna make the observation that I suppose when you're kids, it's the joy of discovery, isn't it? Like, you know, it's like you will never discover things for the first time again, so it's just inherently exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, and it was the first form of expression for me, or no, because we were just kids in Bootle, didn't have much, but we borrowed bits of gear and guitars from pawn shops and stuff, and it was the most exciting thing in the world, because we were all into music, and then suddenly we could be this thing that didn't exist before, and we were this little band, you know. It was like nothing ever beat that. Nothing. It was the most elevating, transcendental, exciting thing that ever happened to me, was being there with me three mates and just going ba-da-da-da, you know, and just playing all these songs. It was just, you know, it changed my life, really.
Looking back now, and I think this is actually a good place to close out, but looking back now, because I can hear, I'm even seeing the kind of that first couple of minutes of the movie, and there's things that we obviously won't spoil, but I can still hear teenage John Murphy in that battle at the beginning. But looking back now and all the amazing things you've achieved, what do you kind of look back now, and what would you say to teenage John Murphy, knowing now what you know?
God, what would you say? Because, you know, when you're doing that, you don't think for one second you're ever even going to get paid doing it, you know. What would I say? Something like, chill out, it's going to work out, and you're not going to believe where it's going to go. So keep practicing, kid, and stop doing that baba baba on everything. Learn to play the piano. I'd probably tell him to learn to play a bit of piano, but I didn't learn to play piano till too late. Yeah, and learn to play piano. You're going to need it one day. That's what I would say.
The movie's amazing. I really, really love it. The score is incredible. It's an absolute game changer. John, it's been a great privilege to be able to catch up with you again. Good luck with everything that's going on with the movie. I know by the time this gets out, the movie will have been out a week. Hopefully it's a huge, huge, huge success for you all. And just brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Sean. It's been a pleasure. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, John. Yeah. Pleasure as always.
All right. Cheers, guys.
Searching for a family until we found each other. Are you ready for one last ride?
We'll all fly away together
into the forever in a beautiful sky.
John Murphy there talking to Sean and I about the music of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. Sean, what an interview.
Yeah, he's wonderful, isn't he? I will admit that when we started speaking to him, I think we actually, we got him early in the morning his time, and I was a bit worried. I was thinking, oh no, are we going to be throwing all these kind of philosophical questions at him, questions about his process and his structure, and it's like, oh no, I'm gonna feel he thawed out immediately, you know, as warm as ever and as funny as ever and as knowledgeable as ever, and the insights into his happiest moment of musicianship being when he was a child, because it was all about that thrill of discovery. That's lovely to hear. Love that.
Yeah, we caught John at a time when it was a couple of days before the movie opened, and so it was all systems go in terms of the PR machine that I'm sure the entire cast and crew are going through at that time for the movie, coupled with the fact that I'm sure John has like 5 million other things that he's also juggling at once alongside the release of the movie. So he had to have, as composers often do, we speak to many composers, mate, who tell us how they're sometimes working on cues till 3, 4, 5 in the morning. And then we caught him very early in the morning. So thank you to John for not only keeping that on course, but also being an absolute champion and powering through that despite any questions we may have thrown at him. And he did absolutely rise to the challenge, and we are all the more grateful for it. I had a lot of fun with it. John is one of my favourites, because I always have a great time with John, and he's a really good chat. Funny, funny guy as well, and incredibly talented.
And you can hear his talent that resonates and courses through the Guardians 3 score, which is inarguably one of the greatest things he's ever done. The choral work is stunning, the thematic work is really interesting, and yeah, I think certainly one of the finest scores in the Marvel canon's date. Yeah, I'd encourage everyone to go and listen to the Guardians Volume 3 score. Not just the needle drops, because the needle drops do take a lot of attention, understandably, because James Gunn uses them really well. But please do pay attention to John's work, because it is fantastic.
I think it's unavoidable. I mean, to be honest with you, I've seen the movie, at the time of recording, I've seen the movie 3 times, and each time it's completely obvious to me that John's score literally reaches out and grabs you by the throat. And also really, you know, really tugs hard on the heartstrings. There's a theme that runs throughout the movie. And again, I'm dancing around this very carefully because I don't want to spoil it for anybody. But there is a theme that particularly surrounds Rocket and his friends that resurfaces continually and gets stronger and stronger throughout the movie. And there are certain moments in the movie when it really does have you choked up. It's incredibly powerful. And to the writing, it's like John was saying, the writing's all there, the performances are all there, everybody in this process is firing on all cylinders, and it's already an incredibly powerful, incredibly emotional set of scenes. But when you just add that magic of John's music, it really does make it incredibly difficult not to crack with emotion, you know?
And that's what a great film composer is there to do. He's there to coax out those inner emotions that don't have physical form. And that's what he does magnificently in this.
I would agree. And I would argue it is certainly a contender for score of the year, certainly for comic book score of the year so far. It's definitely above and beyond. And you can tell he's doing his very best work here as well, which is really fantastic. You can get the album. It is available now digitally. I understand a vinyl release is also coming, which is very, very good news. Those will be available via Hollywood Records, which is of course under Disney Music, so do check that out. You can stream it on all platforms now, so by all means go and check that out. The film is currently playing in cinemas and theatres across the world. I will of course say a thank you to the View Cinema here in Gunwolf Keys, right by where I record the podcast, for all their help with making sure that they didn't stop me from basically living in screen one on more than 2 occasions, and just got to a point where they're like, John's back. Yeah, he's probably going to watch Guardians again. Just leave him.
That when they bring out the sleeping bag.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's a Guardian sleeping bag as well. It goes with my Guardian slippers and my Guardian's hoodie. Anyway, no, I want to thank the View Cinemas. You can find a View near you at myview.com. By all means, do that as well. So big thanks to them for making sure, not only on this podcast, but all our podcasts in the Need a Bigger Pod family. They do give us a lot of support with making sure we've seen everything we need to say. Also, huge thanks to Marvel and Disney. They did, of course, make sure I saw the movie before it came out, so I want to say thank you to them for all their help and support with that as well. And what a film. It's out there right now. I'm looking forward to my 4th, 5th, and 6th viewing of it. You can see it, like I say, in cinemas across the globe. I think that's us for this week. Thank you very much for listening. There's plenty more where that came from. Keep it locked here to the We're Gonna Need a Bigger Pod channel on all your favorite podcast platforms. Follow at Need a Bigger Pod on socials, and of course do like, subscribe, and share with your friends. Anything else to say from you, my dear friend Sean? Anyone you'd like to thank, or any particular brand partners you'd like to support?
I'd just like to say another big thank you to John himself for really finding the time to deliver such a enthusiastic and fantastic interview. Thanks to everyone at Disney and White Bear PR for helping to set up the interview as well, because we know it's always, whenever you deal with these comic book properties, it's always a bit of a sensitive issue in terms of dancing around spoilers and getting time with people. It's always a bit of a complex arrangement. So yeah, thank you to everyone who helped to set that up and facilitate such a brilliant chat.
There will be a list of credits, or end credits, I like to call them, on the page that you find this on. It was particularly if you're viewing this on it, or listening to this, sorry, on any platform, do view the description page. You'll see it really does take a village to make a podcast. And there were a lot of people involved, and everybody was kind of running around to help us make sure that we got this done. Like you said, as Sean pointed out, folks at Disney and Disney Music on both sides of the Atlantic, by the way, not just in the UK. And also, as I say, thanks again to White Bear PR and to John himself, who I've had many great conversations with, not just on the air but off the air as well. We do keep in touch, so I want to thank him for making sure that we were on his schedule. So yeah, cool. All right. If there'll be nothing else, my friend, I think we'll say goodbye for this week.
And goodbye.
And goodbye. On to the next one, then. Thank you very much. And do remember to keep collecting those soundtracks. Go and watch Guardians and pre-order that vinyl. You know you want to.